For more information on Ancient Dragon Zen Gate, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please visit our website.
It's my great pleasure to introduce my old friend, Hozan Allen Sanaki, who's our guest speaker here tonight at Ancient Dragon Zen Gate. Allen is currently the vice abbot at Berkeley Zen Center. He is, amongst many other things, also the leader of the Clearview Project, which is supplies resources to for social action and in South Asia. He's the former head of the Zen Buddhist Association, Soto Zen Buddhist Association, and of the executive director of the Buddhist Peace Fellowship, and author of is your book called The Bodhisattva's Embrace? Is that right, Alan? Yes, and also a very fine bluegrass musician, and the father of two very good Zen Buddhist practitioners. So I'm glad that Alan's with us tonight. I also want to mention Alan's coming to us from Berkeley, and there are climate fires all around from Santa Cruz up to Sonoma and north, and many Zen temples and Zen practitioners are some have evacuated from their spaces, I think, and others are preparing to. So we're not doing a formal well-being dedication tonight, but please keep in mind all of our Zen friends in Northern California who are facing the fires. So Alan, thank you very much for being with us tonight.
Thank you, Taigen, and greetings again, friends. It's wonderful to be here with you. I can smell the smoke. I cannot see the hills, which are very close, and get reports of friends to the north and to the north of the peninsula, and also down south towards Santa Cruz, who have been evacuated, some whose homes have been destroyed. Tassajara has been evacuated. Gil Fronsdale's retreat center in Scotts Valley has been evacuated. My wife, Lori, who some of you may know, was on with a social justice call this afternoon. It seems that the huge prison complex in Vacaville is being threatened by fire. The whole area around the prison has been evacuated, but the prisoners are still there. They're just there. There's no place that the state can figure out to send them. So our heart goes out to them. And also, I want to remember Jacob Blake, who was shot in Kenosha, which is pretty close to you, right? It's just up the lake between Chicago and Milwaukee. Yeah. And this is nothing new, but each one of these events just stirs our heart and shakes us very deeply. So I think it brings to mind my topic tonight is an appropriate response, and looking at what do we think is an appropriate response? What does this mean? So this is a case from the Blue Cliff Record, one of the wonderful collections of koans. It's case 14 in the Blue Cliff Record. a monk asked Zen Master Uman, what is the teaching of the Buddha's whole lifetime? And Uman replied, an appropriate response. Master Uman, or Yunmen in Chinese, was a crafty guy, a master of what we call live words, and one of the most quoted teachers of the Tang Dynasty. He lived reportedly from 862 to 949. And I was moved by this story. One day when Uman was in his 80s, he composed a farewell letter to the king. And he gave a lecture to his monks. And he said, this is my final lecture. And he finished with this statement. Coming and going is continuous. I must be on my way. Coming and going is continuous. I must be on my way. So then he put himself into the lotus position and he died. And his preserved corpse was venerated for more than 1,000 years until it disappeared at some point during the Cultural Revolution. Still sitting there, mummified in lotus position. And even though coming and going is continuous, he didn't go anywhere. I just was writing something for the Berkeley Zen Center newsletter, and I checked this story with my teacher, Sojin Roshi, last night before I wrote it. Sometime when the Zen Center, before it had moved to where it presently is, it was on Dwight Way, and they had a big old house with this beautiful Zendo in the attic. And one very early morning, people would come for Zazen in the morning and the afternoon, and one early morning, a policeman saw lights on in the building, and he knocked on the door, and Sojin answered the door, and the policeman wanted to check if that everything was okay. And Sojin gently explained, well, there are people sitting in meditation up there in the attic. That's why the lights are on. And the policeman then asked him, well, where are you going with this? Where do you think this is going to get you, this meditation stuff? And Sojin said, we're not going anywhere. This is just like Yunmen. We're not going anywhere, although coming and going is continuous. So this begins to give you a sense of what an appropriate response might be. There's a number of versions of Yunmen's turning words. There's an unpublished lecture from 1963 by our teacher Shunryu Suzuki Roshi. And he translates Unman's response a little differently. His translation is, the teaching confronts each. And what he says in this lecture is, the teaching given by Shakyamuni Buddha during his lifetime was accommodated to each disciple's particular temperament and to each occasion's particular circumstances. For each case, there should be a special remedy. According to the circumstances, there should even be teaching other than the teachings which were told by the Buddha. In the light of this, How is it possible to interpret and pass down an essential teaching which can be applied to every possible occasion and individual temperament? So I like this. There should be a teaching, should even be a teaching other than the teachings which were told by Buddha. So this word appropriate functions in English as a verb. The verb means to own or to make one's own, to take exclusive possession of. And it's also an adjective, meaning something especially suitable or compatible or fitting. And I think that in a sense, this is the heart of our practice, to own one's thoughts and words and actions, and to aim them towards the liberation of all beings. This is the Bodhisattva vow that we'll chant at the end of this Dharma talk, I imagine. We chant it at the end of every Dharma talk. But still, what is an appropriate response? Zen master Bernie Glassman, who passed away a couple of years ago, formulated a set of teachings called the Three Tenets. I don't know if you've studied these. I find them really cogent and very helpful. And it's a modern teaching, but it's really based on the Three Treasures. It's based on an ancient teaching. And I'll just lay them out very simply. It's a whole other talk to actually talk about them. So the way he frames it, the first tenet is not knowing. It's opening your mind and being receptive to what arises. Not knowing, to me, is basically the same as what Suzuki Roshi called beginner's mind. It is just to me, it's the spirit of Zazen. The spirit of Zazen as we do it is just to be receptive. All of your senses are functioning, your mind is functioning, and you're just allowing everything to flow through you without taking it and putting it in its category or box, without having to figure it out. So it's just taking it in, not making up a story about it. The second of these tenets is bearing witness. And bearing witness is really, to me, it is the functioning of mindfulness. It's applying this open mind, turning that light of attention to our perceptions, our experiences, our thoughts, and constantly going back and forth between not knowing and just really seeing what's unfolding in front of you. Seeing what's unfolding on TV that we see in Kenosha, Wisconsin. Seeing what's unfolding in the Republican convention that's going on now, seeing what's unfolding in the fires that are raging across California, bearing witness to that. The third tenet, I actually heard from my friend Enkyo O'Hara earlier this week. The third tenet the way I frame the third tenet is an appropriate response. Not knowing, bearing witness, an appropriate response. And the wording that Bernie and his students use, it has been evolving over the last few years, but I was gratified to get affirmation from Enkyo that she thought I had arrived at something that really made sense to her. So out of out of this receptivity of mind, out of the bearing witness to the world and to the world inside us and the world so-called outside us, what arises is an appropriate response. So in the last few months, really much longer than that, the actions of our government, of the police forces, of violent citizens, I'd say they have sensitized us to the reality of white supremacy in this country. And this is a reality that reaches back to the earliest days of this nation, as a nation that's dependent, economy dependent upon the enslavement, the forcible enslavement of African peoples, and on the violent removal of indigenous peoples from their ancient lands. The promises, laws, and even constitutional amendments that were made to these people are broken daily. Treaties and territories that from the start fenced in Native people from the land that they were born on, these treaties have never been honored. Their lands have been encircled, narrowed, and environmentally despoiled. So returning to this word appropriate, we live in a time when the land, the rights, the privileges, the wealth of so many beings have been appropriated by the few. And obviously, this is not the way Uman meant the word to. He didn't mean for it to imply that. So recently, I've been working here at Berkeley Zen Center, like all of you, you know, moving our whole program onto a digital platform. And one of the things that I've done is I've created a new YouTube channel with the videos that we are accumulating now from our Zoom talks, videos by Sojin and by myself and all of our teachers. And I'll send you the address for that, the YouTube address for that. So we have this this video channel, and I think one of the first talks that we posted was several months ago after the murder of George Floyd. And I gave a talk that was entitled "Everything is Burning," which I could give that talk next week here too. So the first comment on this YouTube channel, and I don't know who it was that wrote it, not somebody who I recognize, he had a pseudonym, but the first comment was, "This isn't Buddhism, this is political activism. Please stick to the Dharma." So I got that and I took a breath. And I don't dismiss this out of hand. I really take it in and think about it. I promise to keep thinking about it. At the same time, this is a message that I have heard for 30 years. It's a message that I heard from the first day I began working at Buddhist Peace Fellowship. And from my perspective, what is being characterized as political activism, and therefore, of course, dualistic and deluded, is the fulfillment of the Bodhisattva vow. And it's in the spirit of liberation that we see each being as equal in human value. Seeing clearly, seeing free from our deeply imprinted views and prejudices, seeing what's so deeply patterned in me that I'm capable of speaking or acting out harm even before I understand what I'm doing. I want to see that clearly and be able to intervene with myself. This is what I think it means to operate as a bodhisattva, to be able to not be pushed around by your imputations and by your thoughts, by your patterns and habits, but by the Dharma, by living by vow. So I'm sure that some of you who are listening may also have questions about whether I'm veering from the Dharma, whether you're veering from the Dharma. And I think that's fine. I know that I fall really far short of Buddhahood. That's not something that I would contest. But those of you who stay, who are hearing these words, I invite you to hold my feet to the fire, to tell me what you see and what you hear. And at the same time, in this time of pandemic, when it seems like the plagues are being visited on California and so many of our states and regions, when we have fear, when we see environmental threat, when we see the deconstruction of patterns of democracy that we have tried to uphold, I plan to continue to raise these questions. And I want to address them in the spirit of Buddha Dharma. And to say that this Buddha Dharma is also what has saved my life. I had a past as a political activist. In a certain way, I ran up against the end of that script. And it wasn't until I began to find a way of refiguring that in the context of Dharma that I found an appropriate way to respond. So I don't think these are modern distortions of Buddhism. I think the root of the Dharma of equality, of non-discrimination, of peace, are seen in the earliest Buddhist teachings. You can find it. I'm not going to read you, but you can find it in the Vasetta Sutta, where Buddha talks about the equality of all human beings, irrespective of their birth, their place, or particular conditions of their body or color. You can find it in the Agana Sutta. You can find it in the Chakravati Sutta, where he talks about the wheel-turning emperor. You can find it in Ashoka's rock edicts. And you can find it weaving in and out of Dogen's teachings. So life blooms and fades. An appropriate response meets each stage of our life with wisdom and compassion. Those who are really awake and trained, and that does not mean just Buddhists, bring that response to their very last days and their last breaths. This training, is something that I really want to drive home. We call what we do Buddhist training or Buddhist practice. When the first civil rights workers went down to the South as freedom riders, when they went down to integrate lunch counters. Before they did that, they went and they had extensive nonviolence training. And in that training, they did a lot of role play. So they played both the oppressor who was beaten, the oppressed who was beaten, and the oppressor who was doing the beating. And if any of you have done role play, you know it's pretty easy to get into that other role. All of us, we have this within us. We have that aspect of us, of the oppressor. We have that, we have violence within us. We have seeds of hatred within us. And the point of our training is to get us to see it and get us to choose another way to be. So as a person of training, I want to single out Congressman John Lewis, who we lost on July 17th. And he left a posthumous essay. And I want to read you a little bit of that, because I think it's relevant to this question of an appropriate response. He says, "Like so many young people today, I was searching for a way out, or some might say a way in. And then I heard the voice of Dr. Martin Luther King on an old radio. He was talking about the philosophy and discipline of nonviolence. He said, we are all complicit when we tolerate injustice. He said, it is not enough to say it will get better by and by. He said, each of us has a moral obligation to stand up, and speak out. When you see something that is not right, you must say something. You must do something. Democracy is not a state. It's not a state of being. Just as enlightenment is not a state of being. Democracy and enlightenment, John Lewis says, it is an act. And each generation must do its part to help build what we call the beloved community, a nation and a world society at peace with itself." John Lewis's words bring to mind something that I have always valued, that I read in a book by Thich Nhat Hanh years ago. The book is called Peace is Every Step. Thich Nhat Hanh writes, "When I was in Vietnam, so many of our villages were being bombed. Along with my monastic brothers and sisters, I had to decide what to do. Should we continue to practice in our monasteries? Or should we leave the meditation halls in order to help the people who were suffering under the bombs? After careful reflection, we decided to do both, to go out and help people, and to do so in mindfulness. We called it engaged Buddhism." He continues, "Mindfulness," this is my favorite part, "mindfulness must be engaged. Once there is seeing, there must be acting. Otherwise, what is the use of seeing? We must be aware of the real problems of the world. Then, with mindfulness, we will know what to do and what not to do to be of help. With mindfulness, we will arrive at an appropriate response." Still, I would ask, what is an appropriate response? In this final essay of John Lewis's, he continues and he proposes an answer. "Ordinary people with extraordinary vision can redeem the soul of America by getting in what I call good trouble, necessary trouble. Voting and participating in the democratic process are key. The vote is the most powerful, nonviolent change agent you have in a democratic society. You must use it because it is not guaranteed. You can lose it. So, to step up on a soapbox for a moment, this morning we are, what, about 70, 69 days from the election? From 2020 election, which is perhaps the most election in ours or our children's lifetime. And my soapbox is the vote itself. I think that this is an appropriate response. In certain ways, I think it is, it sets, it establishes the ground for any other further response that we might be able to have. So voting is not the only thing we can do. It, of course, goes hand in hand with other forms of acting and speaking. But as John Lewis says, the vote is the most powerful nonviolent change agent you have in a democratic society. It is not guaranteed. So from this Dharma seat, where I feel the responsibility to recognize all beings, irrespective of views and beliefs, I'm not going to talk about who you should vote for. We just had, we've been having these election retreats. I don't know if you heard, if you attended the one that Tigan spoke at. But, you know, if you look at the letters that you write are very interesting. They do not tell you who to vote for. They just talk about the value of and the importance of the vote. So, you know, if you want to know who I will vote for, you can talk to me later or privately, send me an email, and I'll be happy to share my political views. And, of course, you're also welcome to argue with me. Trading views, being open to different points of view is how we learn. But in closing, I return to Thich Nhat Hanh's words. Mindfulness must be engaged. Once there is seeing, there must be acting. Otherwise, what is the use of seeing? Mindfulness, in this sense, is an appropriate response. Sit down. Look inside. And then turn your eyes outward. Seeing is an appropriate response. What is it that I see? And then acting on what I see and think, acting for the benefit of all beings, is an appropriate response. This is how we bring our practice into the world, how our Zazen pervades the universe. So I think that's where I'll end. I think we have some time for questions and answers. And I don't know what your methodology of that is. I leave it, you can tell me.
Yes, thank you very much, Alan. So I will call on people, if you would like to respond to Alan, if you have comments, questions, arguments, whatever, raise your hand. You can also, on the if you go to the participants button on the bottom, you can, there's a, at the bottom of that on the right, you can hit the raise hands, and I'll call on people. And I'll just mention the talk I gave at the Friday at the Wisconsin election retreat, sponsored by the Milwaukee Zen Center, is on our website now.
Great.
So to go along with Alan's. So comments, questions, anyone, please feel free. Yes, Bo.
Thank you for your talk, Alan. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Bo.
Yeah. I guess my question has to do with, you know, just the Jake and Blake story. You know, today, or maybe generally just with like how much is going on in the world. And, you know, even with that story today, I felt this like turning away, you know, this kind of reluctance to turn toward the story. And this kind of, you know, this thought then, there's so much happening, what to do. So I'm wondering kind of what to do in that moment, you know? What's the move when you, you know, and you might not even be aware that you're turning away, but that's sort of what you're doing, you know? So is there some, you know, what to do in that moment, I guess? What's the response to your... If you're lucky enough to notice that you're turning away, what's the response there?
My response is actually, I mean, I had this response in relation to that. I also had a response in much more immediate sense to just a kind of garden variety aversion. We have, you know, we have a practice committee every Monday morning after Zazen. And I've been going to practice committee for 37 years. And sometimes you get tired of the discussions. Sometimes you get, it was somebody speaking. And my response was, I really wanted to turn the sound off. I just didn't want to hear this person anymore. And that was interesting. I caught myself doing that, and I said, wait, instead of turning it off, let me really listen and see what I think is going on and see what my reactivity is and resistance, and also if there's something... Is there something helpful that I might be able to offer? So that, you know, that's garden variety, but that's kind of where the rubber meets the road, because how we conduct ourselves in our own community, how we listen or don't listen to each other is kind of that's the ground for how we respond and don't respond to greater issues in our society. So, you know, Thich Nhat Hanh has this idea of a North Star precept. Is that familiar to any of you? You know, it's sort of like what's your guiding principle? You know, what do you reduce that to? And so something that I evolved with my wife, Lori, over the years. And it, I must say, it evolved from resistance and wanting to turn away. So my North Star precept is, I will not abandon you. And I also think very much of it's a chapter 19 in the Lotus Sutra. It talks about the Bodhisattva never disparage. Mm-hmm. There's a song I've sing about that. And it there's a wonderful line in there. It doesn't mean that you have to throw your arms and embrace everybody. You know, there's a line in that song that says, the Bodhisattva never disparage. He just runs off to a safe distance. And then he turns around and says, I will never disparage you. So you have to have, you may need at first to take a step back. Take a step back and breathe and feel how you've been punched in the gut.
Yeah.
That's the best I can do.
I appreciate that.
Yeah. Thank you.
Fushin.
So yeah, I've been wrestling with the limits that I feel, the limits that I come to, mm-hmm. and my need for rest. And I have considered the importance of the experience of resourcefulness in my own body, mind. And if I'm exhausted and I try to extend myself further, it doesn't do anyone any good.
Right.
So there are limits, and they change, you know, and it could just be 5 minutes. It could be a night. It could be, but in this process, I mean, there is so much. There's so much. And we, you know, self-care is other care also.
Yes.
So I would want us not to try to overextend ourselves, because we can't be helpful then. So, because then we need, you know, other people to take care of us, because we're having a breakdown all of a sudden, right? Which is, so I'm working through things in that way also, recognizing my own limits, but also within the context of a resourcefulness that returns and doesn't turn away, but sometimes doesn't go forward, doesn't try to do something at that moment, right? So thank you.
Yeah. Well, I think that I remember one of my teachers, Robert Aitken Roshi, you know, we would, he was very big on refreshment, you know. So we have these great words, refreshment, that's a pretty cool word, and recreation, you know. We have this opportunity to recreate ourselves moment by moment, but we really have to step out of the, you know, the roiling waters to be able to do that. And I think it's important to have resilience. Everybody has a different need and a different way to do that. And also important to recognize this whole time that we're living in, particularly now in the midst of the pandemic, is deeply stressful. You know, I think that I bet if we really took the time and looked, you're experiencing this. Some of us are experiencing it in our dreams pretty regularly. And so we need to be kind to ourselves and kind to each other, in order to be able to keep on doing the work, because drive will only get you so far.
Thank you, Fuxian and Alan. Other comments, questions, responses? It's a very important issue.
I recognize that to some extent I may be preaching to the choir here.
No, I think there's a range of responses we have to this. Paul, thank you.
Thank you very much. That was a very skillful, I learned a lot. Thank you.
Thank you, Paul. It really means a lot to me coming from you.
And, well, this is a realm that you've been polishing for a long time, and I'm trying to catch up. But anyway, it is a question that I've struggled with for years, and matter of fact, ever since I first started practicing Buddhism, and anyway, your lecture and the way you presented it has deepened my vision, deepened my thinking about it, and I deeply appreciate that. Mm-hmm. Only thing I can think of to say is that I remember after the first session at Tassajara, it was a long summer session, and anyway, and I went into town, and because I've been isolated and focused for so long and without outside stimulation, I went into this cafe, and there's a waitress there, and I could see her deep suffering. I mean, it was just very obvious to me because I was quieted to the point where I could receive that easily. And I went to Suzuki Roshi and asked him, what do I do about this? And he said, to live in society, you have to insulate yourself to some extent. But I was never totally comfortable with that response. I've always struggled with that understanding, because as you say, the Bodhisattva vow is important. Anyway, I'm still struggling with it, but you've furthered my investigation. Thank you very much.
Well, I want to tell a story on you, if that's okay.
Okay, sure.
Paul led a bunch of ill-behaved young men to Japan in 1989. And we were at Rinso-in. Rinso-in is kind of at the top of a little rise, maybe a half a mile from a small crossroads called Sakamoto. And we walked down, there was a little corner store there. And what Paul told us one day was to watch the old ladies at the crossroad, that they came and they would be bowing to each other kind of vigorously and saying basically, exchanging pleasantries that were in and of themselves not necessarily all that meaningful. How are you? Oh, I'm fine. I'm energetic, you know. But what Paul taught us to do, which I think is in line with what I gather from Suzuki Roshi, and it's really great instruction for all of us, before you do something, just watch. Watch the ladies bowing to each other. See, that is the teaching, how they are turning towards each other. And that was a very powerful lesson, Paul. I've never forgotten that.
So thank you.
Thank you for that.
And just to say, Rinso-in is the temple, is Suzuki Roshi's temple in Japan, and his son's temple now. So, yeah. Douglas had his hand up.
Good. Finally got unmuted. Thank you, Alan. I appreciated your talk. I think I felt a certain amount of sympathy with what Bo had to say, that we have this vow to work for the welfare of all beings, and yet these problems are so large, we feel like, what can we do to get things done? But over the past year, I've spent a certain amount of time with Dogen's four Bodhisattva actions, which I know you're very familiar with. And
yep.
And I found that very inspirational, the idea that our generosity and kind speech and beneficial action and together action can have enormous unforeseen beneficial effects, sort of that our, all of those Bodhisattva actions can snowball in effect has been an inspiration to me. It's not getting us off the hook to say, well, you don't have to take this seriously, you can just do anything. But it's encouragement, at least, that any of this Bodhisattva action is not going to be lost.
Right. So one thing that occurs to me from what you're saying, and also in to some degree in response to Paul, it's helpful to have some clarity about the nature of compassion, in at least as I'm using the word, as distinct from empathy. I feel that, again, as I'm using the word, and not everybody uses it the same way, empathy has the implication of merging. Compassion has the implication of meeting a being who's suffering in the form that is appropriate. And in order to do that, there is a component of merging and there's a component of individuation as well. That sometimes you really need to merge, and sometimes that's exactly the right thing to do. But sometimes if you merge, you're actually, if you merge, if you're, if there's a person who's drowning and you're a lifeguard, if you merge with the person that's drowning, you'll both drown. But if you maintain your strength while they're perhaps flailing about, then you can actually save a sentient being. So I think that all of, you know, what Dogen is talking about in the four embracing Dharma in Shishobo, you know, that last one is so wonderful. It's samana tata in Sanskrit, which is the same. It's cognitive. It's the same root as the word same. It's sameness. It's together action. It's it's being in identity with, and there's the implication that we need some degree of merging in order to be effective, in order to enact those other methods of guidance. So this is a dynamic that we have to work with in every situation. You know, to what degree do we merge? To what degree do we stay individuated? What is the balance between, you can ask Taigen, what's the dynamic between guest and host? You know, what is that fluidity of shifting, of being able to shift those roles and really pivot as we need to? That's an appropriate response.
Thank you, Alan. If people have to leave, it's almost 8:45. Please feel free to do that. But I want, with Alan here, I want to, you know, if somebody has one more question before we end formally, please feel free. So we have time for one more comment or question or response. If anyone has something, yes, David.
Alan, thank you very much for that talk. I really appreciate it. I might be the newest to Zen Buddhism, maybe, of the people here. I started this year, and I thought I was at a place in my life when I really didn't want to join one more spiritual group. And tonight I am feeling so proud and grateful to be here. My colleague, Larry Rothfield, when I mentioned to him.
Oh, yeah. Really?
You know, Alan? So, yeah. So, you used a phrase that really struck me. You were talking about your life and coming to the end of a line as a political activist, and you talked about reconfiguring your life in the context of Dharma, and that really I love that phrase and how that's, you know, that's different from a, you know, conversion narrative. So I would like to hear I would like to hear you unpack that, what that means, what that meant, and what that would mean to configure somebody's life, my life, your life, in the context of Dharma.
Well, I can tell you how it unfolded, and it wasn't a conversion experience. I really was, what happened was I was in therapy, in psychotherapy, which was when I had a wonderful therapist who I continued to see. And one day I came to her with a whole lot of questions like these really fundamental questions. What am I doing on the planet? You know, what am I supposed to do in life? And she said, oh, that's great, but those are not psychotherapeutic questions. you should explore some spiritual approach to this. So I thought, okay. And that's when I for the first time read Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, which resonated with me very deeply. I had previously 12, 14 years before, learned Zazen and sat at Berkeley Zen Center. So I was back in Berkeley and I decided, okay, I'm going to look for Berkeley Zen Center. And it moved. It wasn't where I had left it, you know. So I went there, and I will say that the experience that I had very quickly, I felt this is home for me. And also what I felt was I looked around and I saw people that I respected, just, and without knowing them so well, just how they spoke to each other, how they moved. And it's very interesting because I didn't meet my teacher for a couple of months, because at that time when I came, he was in Japan. He was receiving Dharma transmission from Hoitsu Suzuki. So it wasn't that I met this great charismatic figure. It was that I actually met a community that felt like that I wanted to be part of. And I could see, I sort of understood that the people I was seeing hadn't been born that way. They had developed practice, everything we were talking about, practice. And I thought, well, I want to do that. Can I do that? And I put myself in that way. And I still, and then very shortly, what happened was, very shortly, within a couple of weeks, I discovered there was something called Buddhist Peace Fellowship, and that people were actually integrating a view of social and political reality with the Dharma. And I just thought, hey, this is for me. But then the work had to, then I had to do the work. And the work was just really showing up at Zazen every day, showing up at all the sesshins, and really throwing myself into the life of community. And at the same time, recognizing that I still had, there was still a large canvas that I was trying to paint on, that I hadn't forgotten the world. So that's the short story.
Thank you.
And then just to say, several months after that, I'd always wanted to go to Tassajara. When I first heard about Tassajara, when I first started practicing, it's like people were going to Tassajara and coming back, and I thought, oh, I couldn't do that. That's for the real Zen students. It's for the real Zen students who had already been practicing for 2 months, you know. So as soon as the guest season started, I went down there. And who met me at the gate but Taigen, my friend from Colombia. And I felt totally welcomed and included in that world. So very fortunate. Really, it's all very fortunate.
So, yes, I was that summer I was head do on at Tassajara. I'd been living at Tassajara for 2 or 3 years, and I saw coming that a guest student was coming named Alan Sanaki, and I knew that had to be Alan. There couldn't be two people with that name. we had known each other very well quite a while before, and the band he was in practiced in my apartment sophomore year, and anyway, we went way back. So, and we've remained good friends since. So, thank you for coming to Tassajara.
Yes, and I'd say that Taigen and I are particularly close because we have very parallel views of the relationship between practice and the world. That's a whole other lecture. Dijong's fields. What do you call the world? But yeah, we won't go there.
and the world is changing, and the world is really changing, and the world is changing. And boy, what a year this is. Okay, So thank you, Alan. David, would you
take... Bye, Sil.
And thank you, Sylvia, for coming. Come again. As I said, Alan has two wonderful children who are Zen practitioners in their own right, and one of them is here with us tonight. So, David, would you give us the concluding chant?
I will do that. And by your leave, everyone, I'm going to hit this mute all button. Now I'm going to share the screen. Beings are numberless, I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless, I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable, I vow to realize it. Beings are numberless, I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless, I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable, I vow to realize it. Beings are numberless, I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless, I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable, I vow to realize it.